G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Calling Monster Island. Calling Monster Island.
And now, your hosts.
One is me. And the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts gets together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me, I do not have my co-host because Andrew could not be here tonight, but with me I have...
Hey, this is Brendan.
This is Parker.
And with us tonight, we have a new voice on the show. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Elfie, and I'm very happy to be here.
So, Elfie, what's your history with kaiju movies?
So, it started when I was really little. Like any kid, I was, like, super into dinosaurs. And at some point, when I was, I think I was probably, like, only 2 or 3 years old. Maybe four. But it was somewhere around there. My grandpa gave me a Imperial Godzilla figure, the one with the lipstick, you know? And I loved it. And from there, I was, like, obsessed with Godzilla. And I had to see every movie I could. And so I grew up watching every Godzilla movie I could get my hands on. For a long time, it was just Godzilla. And I was also, like, really obsessed with Mothra. And then as I got older, I started to explore the genre more. I think when I was about 18 years old, I decided to just binge every single kaiju movie that I could find. And I was just kind of fascinated by the genre and all of the different themes you could explore with it. Especially as I got older and realized I was trans, that was, like, there's kind of, like, an allure to the idea of this, like, misunderstood, like, sort of unique thing. They're, like, kind of, you know, either, like, there aren't that many of them or they're alone. That's kind of the lens that I tend to view a lot of this stuff in. And also, I just think giant monsters are really f***ing cool.
I agree. They are really f***ing cool. Hence, this whole thing. But thank you for finally joining us. You know, we've mentioned you several times on the show, so it feels like it's been a long time coming to actually have you here talking with us.
Yeah, I'm really excited and happy to be here. I've been wanting to do it for a while. And thank you for having me.
Hell yeah. So today, the random number generator has told us that we should discuss 1966's The War of the Gargantuas, directed by Ishiro Honda and written by Kaoru Mabuchi, and also Ishiro Honda, with a story by Ruben Berkovich. When a new giant monster begins wreaking havoc in Japan, Dr. Paul Stewart and Okemi Togawa are puzzled upon hearing the claims that the gentle giant they used to care for, Frankenstein, is behind the attacks. Could the monster they know really be behind this? During an encounter with the Japanese self-defense forces and their new maser cannons, the beast is rescued by Frankenstein, now being called Sanda. Dr. Stewart concluded that Gaira, the more aggressive of the two, at some point must have grown from tissue left behind by Sanda. Sanda soon realizes that his brother has been eating humans. This sparks a war between the two gargantuas. Dr. Stewart and Okemi try to convince the self-defense forces to not kill Sanda, but their efforts fail. As the brawl moves out into the ocean, bombs dropped by the self-defense forces trigger an undersea volcano to erupt, killing both Sanda and Gaira, leaving Okemi devastated. Opening thoughts, what do you guys think of this movie?
This has always been a weird one for me. It's been really highly regarded both in and out of fandom, but despite those high expectations, it's never really worked for me. There's some parts I really dig, like the horror elements, the suit acting, music. There's other parts I really, really don't. I've never known where I really stand on it, but I can just say it's good.
I think I saw this movie for the first time like a decade ago. I bought the Classic Media DVD that comes with Rodan, and I was so excited to see it because I'd always seen it talked about as like this like ultimate classic of the kaiju genre, like one of the best. And I hate to show up my first episode talking trash about a beloved movie, but I think it's just so dull, and almost nothing that it sets out to do is executed well. And yeah, I just think it's a really dull slog of a movie. You know, there's great parts to it, especially, you know, the effects and the suit acting, but it's just, I don't know. I've watched it a million times since then, trying to figure out what people love about it. And I don't get it.
Yeah, that's honestly my feelings as well. I keep on going into it. I've watched it 3 times now, including this podcast watch, trying to like it, and I never got connected with me. And it, like, I should love it on paper. Such a cool idea. Like, friggin' troll oni monsters running around eating people that are, like, small enough to wreck crap. But I don't know. Just never worked for me.
Yeah, I sort of land in a confusing place on this movie. I think it's got a lot of really great stuff in it, specifically the kaiju stuff and the miniatures. But as a whole, everyone just seems so bored. And the whole thing seems so, not forced necessarily, but it seems like no one wants to be there. So it makes the whole thing kind of boring and dull. I don't think it's the worst thing out there, but definitely not the best.
I have never seen this movie until we had to watch it for this. And I wasn't really sure what to think, because for a long time I had only heard good things about it. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, something changed. And I had only ever heard bad things about it. So I will not only, but a lot more of the majority was a negative. So I wasn't really sure what to expect going in. And it's fine. I'm not super into it, but I also don't think it's like terrible. I will say, though, take my opinion with a grain of salt, because I was not willing to fork out the dollars to physically buy this movie, and I watched one of the dubs. It was the U.S. dub, which is apparently better than the international dub, which I can believe, because the international dubs are typically garbage. So, you know, I probably didn't enjoy it as much as I would the original Japanese version, but just know I did not watch this film the way it was originally intended.
I would also like to add really quickly, I also watched the dub for this turn, but the last 2 times I watched it was Japanese, and it was about the same, so.
So let's move on to story and characters.
Tell us, Doctor, is your Gargantua alive now?
It's possible. It could be true.
Well, I haven't seen my Gargantua since he escaped. But, even if he did come back, he wouldn't be living in the ocean. And he wouldn't be doing things like tipping over boats or eating human beings.
Is it your opinion that Gargantua had nothing to do with the incident at Misaki?
Yes, that's my opinion.
I certainly agree. I cannot believe that he would ever hurt a human being.
For our cast, we have Kenji Sahara as Dr. Yuzo Mamiya, Kumi Mizuno as Akemi Togawa, Russ Tamblyn as Dr. Paul Stewart, and in the Japanese version, he is voiced by Goro Mutsumi, Jun Tazaki as Major General Hashimoto, Kip Hamilton as club singer. I guess for whatever reason, they felt the need to bill her that high. Okay. Yoshibumi Tajima as Hirai, Nobuo Nakamura as Professor Kita, Hisaya Ito as Chief Izumida, and Nadal Carino as Lieutenant Colonel Kazama.
Let's start at the beginning in terms of like the story and everything. The intro to this movie is rad as hell.
It is.
It kind of sets the bar a little too high.
It does.
But the opening with the ship and the lightning and the giant octopus and everything is super rad and super terrifying.
I'm in a weird place with the intro because it is beyond rad. Like, it is one of the most metal possible things you can imagine for to start a movie with, but like every time I watch this, it gets less and less engaging for me.
Yeah, I think that the beginning is like the best part of the movie. It opens really strong. The atmosphere is incredible. You have this storming heavy rain, you have this kind of swirly misty look to the clouds. The octopus is really well done. It looks spectacular. And then the reveal of Gaira is amazing. And I'm not into humanoid kaiju usually, but Gaira is terrifying. It opens in such a way you think you're in for something really special, but it just kind of, it never really reaches that same peak again. Like, that's like it.
Yeah, I mean, just the story in general is just, like, Dr. Stewart and Akemi's story, like, there's not really a story there. It's just Gaira is causing a ruckus, and the whole thing is them being like, oh man, like, do we think it could be our Gargantua? And then they're like, no, there's no way, he's too nice. And then once Santa does show up, then it just becomes them trying to get them to not kill him, barely trying. And then it doesn't even work. And I'm just kind of like, what was even the point of this? There's nothing here.
Yeah, it's kind of like, first of all, Russ Tamblyn is the best actor here, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly putting in the most effort.
He carries the whole movie. But yeah, no, I think that the story is really interesting in concept. It kind of needs context. I don't think the movie works well on its own completely. Like, you kind of need to see Frankenstein Conquers the World if you care, like, about what's happening, I think. But I think the idea is really amazing. Like, I think it's wonderful. So you have this, because you have these two creatures and they come from the same place. There are two things that just kind of, like, shouldn't exist. And so, like, for Santa, finding another creature, another person like them, that's like this really huge thing, you know, and to find out that the only other thing in the world like you is this horrible monster. There's a lot there. There's a lot that you can do with that. That's really interesting, and there's a lot of pathos there. But the movie never really does much with that. I mean, I don't think Santa's characterized the best. I think that the way that he emotes and everything, it's just very kind of like basic and repetitive. And it doesn't, I feel like not a lot of emotion comes through. And I don't know. I just don't think it quite works. And the story surrounding it is so, everything else surrounding it is so meandering. It's mostly just a bunch of paint by numbers, like scientific and military planning and the military setting up and doing their thing. So I just don't think there's a lot to support those ideas.
Yeah, for sure. The story between the two Gargantuas is absolutely a great concept, but there's just the humans themselves, just there's nothing going on.
Well, yeah, this is something I was going to touch on at some point too, is that the movie itself, you know, works really well as it can on its own as an independent film. But at the same time, Gelfie was saying, to get the added context, you really sort of have to watch Frankenstein. But that's problematic because as a sequel to Frankenstein, it doesn't really work. There's really nothing with Santa that, at least for me, evokes anything of Frankenstein from Frankenstein Conquers the World. Like, there's nothing there to even remotely connect those two characters except sort of the Dr. Stewart character, sort of. But again, like I said, it's frustrating though, because pretty much the entire human conflict, aside from stopping giant monsters, relies on that film existing. So, but it's very strange because, like I said, it's sort of like it contradicts itself and it hurts the movie, but also at the same time, it hurts the movie if you don't watch it and you're not familiar with it. It's a very frustrating position to be put in.
Yeah, I feel like this is the real shift in the series where it stops being human stories intercut with a wider kaiju story and starts becoming, there's kaiju stuff going on, and they're the main bulk of the story, and there's this group of humans who are just kind of, like, watching it. I don't know how to explain it. It's just, it feels very much like, oh, let's go see what those gargantuas might be. And then, here's the gargantuas, and then that's it. That's all you get. And, like, I do genuinely think Gaira and Santa are really good characters, so it could work. But the problem is that the human characters are just so fucking boring. I cannot, like, everyone who's not Kumi Mizuno are just kind of, like, there. Everyone feels like the boring side character that, like, starts explaining the story before, like, the Akira Takarada or the Kenji Sahara, which is ironic because he's actually in this film, who's the main character, shows up to, like, start leading the story, and we focus on him and his charisma. But no, just these are the characters. Enjoy them. In the Steven Rifle Honda biography, it's mentioned that this was really the point where making kaiju films every year for Toho started to bother Honda, especially after he was fired and became a contract director. And you can really feel it. This is the most by the number 60s kaiju flick I can think of.
I think that the one person who really cared making this movie was Haro Nakajima. His performance as Gaara is wonderful. It's like the one thing in the movie that like shines the whole time. Everyone else is just kind of there to be there. None of them have any kind of personality, unless being bored all the time is like a personality trait. There's nothing going on with any of the characters that's interesting. Sanda and Gaara are the real, like, characters. They're the only thing that, like, really drives the movie. They're the only characters in the movie that matter.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. They're really the only characters in this that matter. I mean, Brendan, you said that everyone but Kumi Mizuno is just kind of there. But, like, even her, like, all her character does is just kind of be distraught about what's going on. But, like, she doesn't actually do anything. Like, nobody does anything. And I think that really hurts the movie. Everything is just kind of the characters, like, standing around talking about the gargantuas, but not really doing anything meaningful. Again, they just don't do things, and it makes it a rough watch in the human character scenes.
You know what's funny about Kimi Mizuno's character is she doesn't work without the context of the previous movie. All of her feelings towards the gargantuas, or in Sanda in particular, it all comes from the previous movie, which the movie also like doesn't tie itself to well. It's strange. Like, early in the movie, it spends a bunch of time kind of, like, retconning that movie. And I don't know. It's just, it's weird. It's really strange to me how it's so, like, it feels like it's really, like, tied to that movie, but distant from it at the same time. And I think it actually creates a problem in terms of her character.
Well, I think the thing, too, with her character is, like, look, this is one of very few movies that I can think of, like very few, where it is very obvious that no one wants to be there. Like, I think there's maybe two or three exceptions to that. I would agree she's potentially one of them, but you can see the disconnect between her and Tamblyn. Like, there is, not only is there no chemistry, they are clearly, or I should at least say she is very clearly, very obviously not fond of him. Like, you can just tell in the way she looks at him that she is not fond of him. It's really a shame because I think a potential sequel to Frankenstein with the concept that there's another Frankenstein that is different than ours, that there's different personality traits, there's different desires, there's different reactions, different environments and whatnot. Like, I think that's a very interesting concept, but it just doesn't work as a sequel.
So I have actually not seen Frankenstein Conquers the World yet. So I don't have the context, which maybe affects how I view this character. So, I mean, if you guys want to fill me in, feel free with that character. I mean, because
basically all it is, if I remember correctly, is that she's just sort of how she is in this, where she's just affectionate towards Frankenstein. The difference is, though, is that in Frankenstein Conquers the World, she literally helps to raise him, and they form like sort of a bond, sort of like a King Kong and Darrow kind of, but with a little bit more to it, because she's actually there the entire time he's growing, which is why she's so quick to come to Sanda's defense in this. The only problem with that, though, is that, like I said, I cannot make Sanda and Frankenstein be the same character in my head. Like, they are so completely visually different, they act different, everything about them. It's just polar. Like, to me, they're not even the same character. I know they're supposed to be, but they're just not.
So wait, Sanda is supposed to be the Frankenstein from Frankenstein yes. Conquers. I didn't even realize that.
That's what they're suggesting. At least, I mean, that's what I recall. I'll be honest, I kind of zoned out for like half this movie last night. But yeah, the idea that Sanda is their Frankenstein, and that's why they're so quick to kind of like, she's a little bit more protective, and that's why like, she goes right up, like when they're in like the train station or whatever, when she walks right up to him, because the idea is that Sanda's that Frankenstein. Again, I can't make those two match in my head, but that's what they're suggesting.
Okay, I had no idea. I mean, I guess that makes sense. I mean, the English the original US dub like kind of makes it no longer a sequel. So I guess I had just assumed that it was just whatever the events of Frankenstein Conquers the World were happened. And then this character raised Sanda or whatever. And then for whatever reason, no longer had Sanda. And then all of this happened. I don't know, but that makes more sense now, I guess. But I really need to see that movie.
They try to do that retcon where they flash back to Frankenstein as a child and it looks like Sanda. They try to do that to sort of make it blend a little better. But I could totally be wrong. I mean, I'm not an expert on Frankenstein Conquers the World or War of the Gargantuas, but my understanding is that they are trying to propose that Sanda is indeed the same Frankenstein. They do a little bit of like a retcon sort of, but that's the idea.
I personally can't tell if it's supposed to be the same Frankenstein or if they are saying that since this regenerated from the remains of the previous Frankenstein, that its behaviors should be similar. I can't really tell, but yeah, they do try to like reconcile the visual difference by putting the kid in the monkey suit, and it looks absolutely heinous.
It does. It looks pretty bad.
Yeah, it's really bad. But I can't figure out. I don't think that the subtitles, it could just be the translation, or it honestly could just be the writing. I don't think that it's a particularly well-written movie, but I find it very difficult to tell what they're trying to imply.
I just looked it up, and evidently the idea here, according to Gojipedia, is that Sanda's believed to be the result of Frankenstein's flesh breaking off in the mountains of Japan. Over time, this severed flesh grew into Sanda, who was discovered by scientists. And as a child, Sanda grew up in a research facility under the care of Akemi. So I guess she took care of two Frankensteins? I don't know how much I like that, but whatever.
That just makes it more confusing.
I would agree.
Honestly, part of the reason it's so hard to tell for me, at least, is that they spend the entire movie calling every single monster Frankenstein. Kyra, Frankenstein. Sanda, Frankenstein. They don't ever get their actual names in the dubs I've seen, or even the subtitles of the ones I've seen. But on the other hand, I also feel that it feels like a weird retcon kind of thing. You know, like when you have a film and then the sequel doesn't do as good. So then you make another sequel where you're like, oh, no, that didn't actually happen. Like the Spinosaurus skeleton being shattered by Rex in Jurassic World, or the bit in whatever the latest Fast and the Furious is where it turns out, oh no, that guy from Tokyo Drift's still alive. Or, sorry, Andrew, but if I'm being off, the entirety of Rise of Skywalker, basically.
You are a Palpatine.
That was actually really cool.
I actually have it in my notes. Somehow the giant octopus has returned.
Yeah. We'll talk about the octopus. We're going to get to that octopus. I have a lot
to
say.
We are going to talk about that octopus.
But it's actually kind of like Evil Dead, too. Like Evil Dead 2.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That's an even better example. Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, they kind of like reshot some stuff to sort of make it fit a little better, but it still serves as a sequel.
But yeah, it's very hard to figure out what this is supposed to be. So either way, I still refuse to believe that stupid friggin' chimp is supposed to be Frankenstein.
We'll just have to use the old noggin, huh?
Yeah, so I guess we should talk about Russ Tamblyn now and his super polite, just such a lovely man on the set of this film.
For those who do not know, Russ Tamblyn, when cast in this film, thought the script was awful and Ishiro Honda was, quote, a hack, and so put in the least amount of effort possible, including going on top of ad-libbing his own lines because he thought his little jokes were funnier than anything that actually happened. I need to go grab my Honda autobiography to check. It's not an autobiography. I always call it that. Jesus Christ. Honda biography to check. But I also believe he had an actual full-on argument with Honda on set.
Yeah, so he was terrible. His behavior was pretty awful. And it really shows how little respect he had for the film and everyone involved. But to his credit, he has since admitted that he was a shit and that he regrets the way that he behaved. He said that he was really stuck up. I don't know his exact words, but it's something along those lines. He said he was really stuck up when he was that age. Thought he was like the shit. Just to give him some credit.
I found my biography so I could explain it. So apparently, there wasn't an argument. I was wrong about that. But Tamblyn was not a fan of the film. He apparently mainly did it because I was offered money and my wife at the time said I always wanted to go to Japan. He was not a fan of filming. He would, after the day was over, he would just go straight back to his suite in the nearest hotel and would not interact with the cast unless he was they were shooting a scene. What I thought was an argument was during filming, during the mountain scenes, he wandered off into a very dangerous area despite Honda and the rest of the crew calling after him. But on the plus side, he genuinely later paid compliments to Honda, saying as much as he disliked the film he was making, he felt like I like working with him because he didn't give me too much direction. The best directors I work with gave me very little direction. And apparently he's, quote, grown to love it. But overall, yeah, you can tell he's just here for the paycheck in the film. And it really drags it down when he's the main lead, especially compared to absolute living Giga Chad Nick Adams.
I only know Russ Timlin from Twin Peaks, prior to this at least. And it's interesting because I think in Twin Peaks he's kind of an asshole too, though I think that's intentional more for his character than it is here. But yeah, I have not watched this with his, because I think one of the dubs has his voice, right? Doesn't he redub the lines?
Yeah, it was the US dub. He redubbed himself.
So I've never heard that version. I've only ever seen the Japanese version. But he just looks so completely, like, almost annoyed that he's actually in the movie. It's very, very distracting.
It's not even just him, though. Everybody seems bored. Everyone seems like they don't want to be there. It's really strange. And I don't know if, like, it's him and everyone just hated being around him that much. Or if it's just the movie. I mean, even the Japanese dub actor for Tamblyn sounds bored.
So he nailed acting like him, yes.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably like not really anything you can do with that while translating that performance. Like, I can't imagine it would be very easy to make him sound more interesting.
To be honest, though, like, now as an actor, I think you should, you know, do your best regardless of what you think of the material. But I don't think that anybody was given anything particularly interesting to work with, including Tamblyn. I mean, he's just playing the typical, like, science fiction doctor science guy, you know? Like, his character doesn't do anything particularly meaningful and he doesn't have any particularly interesting relationships with anybody else. I mean, he has nothing to do, really. No one has anything to do. That's what it feels like to me. It feels like everybody's just kind of meandering through the movie.
Nobody has any particularly interesting character traits or anything like that. It's just every character is just like, okay, this character is a person, and then that was it.
It's funny. I was just going to say maybe I have nothing else to say about characters, but then I remembered what's his name is in this. That's in like every Godzilla movie, and I can't think of his name because I'm a fake fan.
Kenji Sahara?
Sure. He played the military guy.
Oh, Yoshibumi Tajima.
Sure.
But Sahara is in the most Godzilla movies, so there's that.
who is he in Gargantuas?
You know, the guy. He was a scientist, I think, in this.
Oh, yeah. That guy. Yeah, that guy. Yeah.
Wasn't he in Frankenstein, too? I can't remember.
Kumi, I thought.
Yeah, that's the weird part, is that it's basically the same cast, except now Russ Tamblyn is here instead of Nick Adams, sadly.
Kumi Mizuno, Takahashi Shimura is in it, though. Why aren't we watching that? Why aren't we talking about that? Why aren't we talking about Frankenstein?
It's not my fault. It's the random number generator's fault.
You sound like Lando in Empire Strikes Back. It's not my fault.
They told me they fixed it.
But I was going to say we should talk about him, but there's really nothing to say. So, I mean, like...
Nothing.
Nothing.
I can say that it was weird hearing a different voice come out of his face.
The thing about this movie is that I find it really hard to talk about the characters because there's just nothing interesting to talk about. There's almost nothing.
I am surprised that we have said as much as we said about
them. I feel like we've been saying the same thing.
That's true. It's pretty much just been nobody does anything. Nothing is interesting. So let's move on to monsters and special effects. The director of special effects for this film was Eiji Tsuburaya, and Gaira was played by Haruo Nakajima, and Sanda was played by Hiroshi Sekida. Yeah, I mean, we talked a good bit about Gaira already, and Sanda, really. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, those two are the saving grace of this movie. They're the one thing that was holding my attention. When the two of them were on screen, I actually felt at least mildly invested. And I can't say that for anything else in this movie.
Gyra's fucking terrifying. Like, not even joking, it is genuinely one of the most disturbing kaiju out there for me. The one scene that really got me this time was when the sailor is recounting his story of being attacked by Gyra, and he's just, like, full-on hauling ass swimming after them, and they're, like, struggling to make it through the waves. That is horrifying to me, both because, as I've mentioned before in King of the Monsters and Daimajin, one of my favorite mini tropes in kaiju stories is a massive monster who has its sights set dead on ending you specifically, which is terrifying, but it's just the speed he's going at. He's like full on, like, he's there to eat, and it's scary. Like, we've had plenty of other human eating kaiju, like Kamakuris, Kamunga, Gauss, the Skull Crawlers, but for Gaira, it feels like personal. He's not just really doing it because he's hungry, he's doing it because he loves to eat. Like, I've always found the whole spitting out human glow things really terrifying, and like, Nakajima fucking sells it.
He's terrifying, and that's in part the performance, and in part the design. His face is just disgusting. It's terrifying. There's this scene early in the movie, these fish, I think it's fishermen, they look over the side of the boat and they see Gaira's face under the water. And I think it's the best shot in the whole movie. It is grotesque. It's amazing. And I really wish, I mean, there's some moments here and there, I think, that do this, but I really wish that the movie had really leaned more into the horror aspect. How scary Gaira is.
I would actually go so far as to say, with the exception of the Rodan sequence where you see the egg hatch, with the exception of that and the Shakara scene in 84, Gaira swimming after those sailors is like the scariest thing in a kaiju movie. The other one that gets me too is when he first shows up at the airport and he eats that woman and then like spits out her like shoe or something or the flowers or whatever. He's so indifferent about it. It's so like, it's just obviously they're just food and that's it. And it's really freaky. And then his run away from the airport is both hilarious and terrifying. I'm not really sure where I land on that. But no, Gaira carries this movie completely for me. 100%. He's great.
Just want to say really quick that the shot of the flowers on the ground with the broken glass around it is real cool.
Like I said earlier, I think he's like the one thing about the movie that really shines like the whole way through. He's terrifying. I was going to say something about that shot where he eats that woman and like spits out her clothing or whatever. I think that's one of the most graphic sequences. Obviously it's not graphic, but it's like the closest it gets in these movies, I think. I can't think of another instance of them showing something like that in a Toho monster movie, like that kind of like really direct monster on human violence, aside from maybe getting stepped on. It comes off really nasty. That whole sequence and everything Gaira does leading up to it is actually it's scary. Like Nakajima really sells it.
Yeah, he totally does. And that whole airport attack is just really fantastic. It's obviously one of the highlights of the movie. I think it like the crowd panicking is, in my opinion, some of the best that I've seen in this genre. Like, you could really feel the panic, in my opinion. Also in the dub, the dude in the tower urging that plane not to land, that man was giving it his all. That voice actor gave the best performance for any human character in the entire movie. He was really feeling the emotion there.
Attention! All aircraft are to turn away! An alert! An alert! This is Tokyo Tower! Don't land!
To me, the thing that really sets this film and Frankenstein apart, even though I haven't fully watched Frankenstein yet, is the scale. Like, that's the thing that came across me the most during the airport scene. By sending these monsters in, like, the 20-meter, 30-meter range, they feel more dangerous. Because, like, they're fast. Sure, they're big enough to wreck buildings, but they're also fast enough to, like, target you individually and, like, actually full out run and weave around. Like, seeing guy run away, like Parker saying, is genuinely kind of terrifying. We don't really see that kind of speed in a kaiju before. It really does stand out.
Yeah, the scale is something that I had wanted to mention too, because it makes it like it allows the miniatures to sort of like look. I mean, I love all the miniatures in these movies, but at this scale, it just makes it a little more, I guess, intimate or easier to sort of connect with what that thing is. Like the ships, or one thing that always stands out to me is when I think it's right after, I think it's the second military attack. But Gaira is running and he kind of like jumps over the tanks, and the tanks are very obviously like really large and substantial. And I mean, not for nothing, Gaira also gets hurt pretty damn bad by the masers and by the military. Like it makes it so there's like Godzilla is always a threat. The concept of Godzilla stepping on you is terrifying, but the concept of like Gaira stepping on you is probably even more terrifying, because there's a very good possibility that it would only step on half your body. And you're going to sit there struggling. And there's something about the scale that does wonders for the intensity and the miniatures. The effects work in this is incredible. Absolutely incredible. Like, I think what's really freaky is how, I mean, he kills or attacks the octopus. And then you'd think in like most Godzilla movies and stuff, like, okay, now the monster goes away. Nope. Now it's like, okay, now you have to deal with Gaira, which is way worse. Well, I don't know about way worse. It's a giant octopus. It's kind of awful, but it's he's worse. It's really freaky.
So I don't really care for like the military stuff in this movie. I find it all incredibly boring, but I like when Gaira is like throwing the tanks and they're like smashing those houses. That is great.
I wanted to add the other reason Gaira is so amazing is that when he's not being terrifying, he's being a little like, I don't even have words for it. He's just an asshole. That's like one of my favorite antagonist kaiju traits, like Gigan or Red King, just a total fucking jerk. And Gaira is great in it. Like, there's that whole tank scene I mentioned, but I also love near the climax of the story where he's like, where Santa comes back and he's just like sitting there lazily with a pile of clothes, and Santa growls and he just kind of like looks at him like, what are you going to do about a tough guy? Or when he and Santa are actually fighting, he's like deliberately going after his injured leg. He really just a piece of work, and I kind of love it. On the other side, I do also really love the whole maser attack on him. It gives him a quick moment of sympathy just seeing him being absolutely destroyed. So he's a very character. Mainly an asshole, but a varied character.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on as far as Gaira goes. Like, the way that he's characterized, it seems like you are kind of supposed to feel sympathy for him at some point. Like, during the Mazer attack, like, he gets pretty shredded. And I'm not sure, I could be reading too far into the movie, which is something I admit I have a habit of doing. But I think there might be an implication that Gaira is kind of the way that he is circumstantially, not because of something inherent. I'm not sure. And like you were saying, Brendan, about those moments between Sanda and Gaira, I think that those are really great, but I wish we had more of that. I feel like the movie doesn't really give them enough time together. You get a few moments where you see Santa's figuring out like how like Gaira is, and you get this sense that like, you know, he cares about Gaira and wants him to be good. But I feel like we needed more of that. I mean, that's the most compelling aspect of the movie, but we don't get much of it.
It feels like they were kind of afraid they couldn't really have a satisfactory climax, but I feel like it would have made it stronger if we got to see like some genuine care between the two of them before Santa realizes Gaira is a predator to humans and all.
I think it's definitely the intention of the movie to suggest that Gaira is not the natural state of the Frankenstein species. I think the idea is, you know, Sanda is raised by Akemi and Dr. Stewart, and is raised in a little bit more of a, you know, while not a perfect, loving, nurturing environment, still one that promoted a little bit more of a positive response on him. I mean, because, you know, to teach him that humans are not, you know, evil or, you know, maybe there are some bad humans, but they're not food. And I think the idea is with Gaira is that Gaira grew up in a little bit more of a hostile natural environment, fending for himself, learning for himself, trying to survive, and probably being a creature like that out in the wilderness would encounter some unfavorable people. I think the thing that could have helped to hammer that home would have been, you know, while we get a flashback to Sanda as a child, it would have helped to see Gaira as a child, maybe showing the hardships that Gaira went through that would maybe warp him and turn him into what he's turned into. I mean, that could be giving the movie a little bit more credit than it deserves, but I think considering Honda as a filmmaker and his other stuff, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think that there's a little bit more depth to than just, okay, you know, Gaira's evil for whatever reason, and Sanda's not for whatever reason. Like, I'm sure there's a reason that's there that maybe should have been explored a little more, but I think there's enough there to back up that perspective.
Yeah, I definitely get a sense that there's like a lot of background stuff that didn't really make it in the movie. I feel like there's a lot of like intent behind it that just ended up being filtered out during the filmmaking process. Because I get the sense, like I mentioned earlier, I get the sense that there's like a lot to this. Like, there's a lot of potential for Sanda and Gaira's relationship, but I don't know. I don't think it's giving too much credit. I think there was intent there. I just think it didn't come through.
I'm trying to find a source on this, but I'm having a lot of trouble right now. But I do remember reading somewhere Honda said his original intent was to make a story about the possibility of cloning, with like the whole nature versus nurture thing is essential, given Gaira and Sanda would have been basically the same individual just under different circumstances. But it was kind of pushed aside and as the production quickened. So I definitely do think there's merit to this idea that it had more potential than was allowed at the end.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I believe he said that either about this or Frankenstein, but I feel like it's this one because that definitely seems like more what this story is trying to talk about. Gaira is one of the few, is the only Toho kaiju who has ever interacted with the Ultraman series, technically.
What? How?
There was a Japanese drama called He of the Sun, which was about, well, I'm trying to find details, but apparently it was just like a suburban drama about day-to-day life. And one episode involved the main character working on a kaiju soundstage where Haru Nakajima played Gaira facing the Ultraman monster Killa on set.
Wow.
Yes.
So, should we just talk about Sanda then?
He looks like the Geico caveman.
He does.
And he looks like an off-brand Halloween mask of Lon Chaney's Wolfman.
So both Sanda and Gaira both look very visually striking, at least when compared against each other. Like, I think the green and the beige really somehow work and kind of complement each other. And there's something sort of iconic about that. But otherwise, Sanda, I don't really have much to say about Sanda. Like I said earlier, I think Gaira completely carries this movie. Sanda kind of feels like a sort of an afterthought. Like, I think you're supposed to feel sort of like, kind of like in Singular Point, where like Godzilla's not really in it until quite later on, but you still kind of feel his presence even though he's not exactly in it. I think that's sort of what's supposed to be happening here. I think you're supposed to be feeling the idea that Sanda's out there. Could this be our Frankenstein? Blah, blah, blah. But like, I never get that impression. So like, when Sanda finally shows up, it's like, yeah, all right, well, okay.
Sanda is a good example of the classic sort of humanish kaiju who defends his little human friend from worse monsters. The only issue is he doesn't have anything memorable about it. He's not cool and gleaming silver like Ultraman. He's not brutal but with a kind soul like Kong. He doesn't have that weird caveman aesthetic of the Toho Frankenstein. He's just a nice ape dude. And that's cool, but he doesn't really do anything memorable with it. The only memorable thing he does is like how visibly fed up with Gaira he gets near the end of the movie. That's the only part that I really like. Other than that, he's just kind of like there to help people. Like that whole scene of him breaking his leg to save Mizuno, I'm just kind of like, eh, good job.
I don't know if I zoned out, but I don't remember him breaking his leg like at all.
I don't remember that either, but I also like tuned out for that entire last half of the movie.
All that happens is a rock hits his leg. It happens pretty fast. It's a weird moment. I don't know. At least I think it is. But Sanda doesn't do much for me. I like Sanda in concept, but in execution, he's just kind of there. to me. I don't know if it's the way he's written or if it's the suit actor, but he never feels like he has as much personality as Gaira does. And once he shows up, the movie kind of feels weaker somehow, which I feel shouldn't be the case because it's their kind of relationship that I feel should, like, be the movie's strength. But I don't know, it kind of just falls short.
So I actually disagree. I don't feel invested in any single way until Sanda shows up. Before that point, it's just, you know, as great as Nakajima is as Gaira, and he is really great, the movie up until that point is just Gaira going on various rampages and Russ Tamblyn and Kumi Mizuno saying whether or not they think it's Sanda, basically. I don't know, but then once Sanda comes in, like, then the movie, like, decides to actually be about something. But granted, I mean, it doesn't have as much impact as it should, because in my opinion, I just think Sanda should be introduced earlier, because if the whole, like, emotional through line of the movie is that these two one-of-a-kind beings meet each other, and, you know, the one, like, tries to help the other one, but then finds out that he's, like, eating humans, and then that one likes humans, so he's, like, real mad about it, and then they have to, like, fight. That deserves more time than it got. And even though I find it to be the most interesting thing about the movie, it's just not... I will say it's still not as interesting as it could be, because they just don't give it the time that I think that concept deserves, and that is disappointing. But I do like Sanda, and I do feel a lot more invested once he comes into the story. Everything else just I don't care about, really.
In theory, I agree with you in terms of it being more compelling once Sanda shows up. I feel like that should be the case, because I think that that's, like, conceptually the most interesting thing about the whole movie. I just don't think it's done in a way that carries the weight that that concept should.
The other kaiju in this movie, the giant octopus, is utterly terrifying. This is sort of embarrassing, but I kind of want to give the movie the credit. It didn't occur to me that it wasn't a real octopus until someone, I think it was Elfie, had pointed out that the eyes fucking glow. So I want to give them the credit for that in terms of the execution, because I think my mind had just gone straight to King Kong versus Godzilla, and I was like, oh, it's just a giant octopus. Yeah, whatever, cool. But that entire, everything about that opening is, like, perfect and terrifying, and the octopus is part of that. It's completely, it's never explained. It's like the beauty of kaiju movies. It's just a giant octopus. It's never explained. Decides to attack a random ship. Why? Who knows? Who cares? It's terrifying and it's awesome.
Yeah, that was me. Octopus are indeed not actually evil in real life.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Yes, you are.
No,
they are. They are. Are aliens intent on taking?
Listen, I love octopuses, but we have no idea what their moral alignment is.
Their DNA. They're like the only species on the planet that has a different type of, like, completely different DNA construction than any other creature on this planet. And they're, like, scary smart. And no, they're evil.
I think that the octopus scene is wonderful. Out of all of the kaiju movies I've seen with a giant octopus, I can think of three off the top of my head. Someone let me know if there's another. I think this one's probably the best, like, octopus effect. Because, I mean, not counting King Kong versus Godzilla, like, that's a real octopus, and the prop is not that great. Like, I think the octopus prop is really, really good. And while they're not realistic, I love the glowing eyes. I think it's a really cool effect. That whole sequence is just oozing with atmosphere. It's fantastic.
As someone who quite loved Odaku's first appearance in the... in King Kong vs. Godzilla, I don't know how to feel about this. I feel like it's nice to see it, but it's, I don't know. I do love the sheer audacity of, like, yeah, there's a giant octopus going on, but it's fine. He's just there to introduce the main villain.
This, to me, is also the best of the giant octopus fights, I guess. Even with the real octopus in King Kong vs. Godzilla, there's still, like, weird, like, compositing and stuff, like, with the people in front of him and everything, and the actual fight itself is, like, kind of lame. It's just King Kong throwing rocks, and then the octopus is, like, on his face, and he has to pretend like he's struggling to get... I mean, whatever. You know, they were working with what they had, I guess, so it's not that big of a deal. But, I don't know. I think this one looks better, and I agree. Like, the glowing eyes is cool. I don't know. For some reason, I'm very, like, I like the fact that there was a short period of time where when you needed a random cannon fodder monster, hey, big octopus. Like, I don't know why. I just think that's fun.
Henry G. Saperstein loved the octopus effects in King Kong vs. Godzilla and insisted on having it in both this movie and Frankenstein because he thought it were just so good it deserved to be there.
Should we talk about the military stuff? We don't have to spend too much time on it because it's not very interesting.
The Mazer tanks are rad. That's kind of all I have to say about military.
I have been waiting for this moment. So the Mazer tanks are my favorite super tech in all the kaiju films ever. Toho, so on. I just absolutely adore them because there's something really practical and real to them. I love the fact they're just kind of like dragged around on these like bases, at least the best ones from the Showa era, and not those modified tanks from the Heisei. Ugh. That was a joke, but yeah, I really do love the Mazer tanks, and I really think they get a great show in this movie. I love how they absolutely go all in on Kyra, just like blowing chunks off of him, which again shows how different he is from like a 50 meter walk it off Godzilla. But it's a really good scene, and I especially loved watching them like slowly kind of like surround the fighting gargantuas at the end of the film. But yeah, I'm a big Mazer tank fan, and I think this is a great introduction of them into the wider Toho pantheon.
Here's my thing. The effects here, like the miniatures and the scale, the way that like the Mazers like cut down the trees, it all looks really fantastic. The Mazers are cool, you know, like it's cool. I hate every second of the military stuff. It is so mind-numbingly dull. There's so much of it, and it goes on forever. It feels like it goes on for like a half hour in the sequence where the military first attacks Gyra in the hills or the mountains, whatever. By that point, I'm falling asleep. It reminds me of the final bombing sequence in Rodan, or the bombing in the end of Godzilla Raids Again, where it's just like never ending. Bombs dropping. It's the same kind of thing. It just keeps going and going and going. And for me, it doesn't matter how good it looks. It's just interminable. And it feels like the movie like stops in its tracks.
I am in total agreement with you. I find those parts just so hard to sit through. They just went on forever. Like, there are like several sequences of the military setting up that like just take way too long. Maybe there's not actually several of them. I only watched it once, but I found them so grating that if there wasn't several of them, it felt like several. But yeah, I can't really say any more than you already said. It's just boring, and it kind of like made it hard to pay attention to the actual like fights between the military and Gyra, because I was just so checked out by the time the fighting started. And also when they're setting up with all those lights and stuff, it feels like the long setting up was done to build tension, except that Gyra's just standing there. Like, he's not advancing on them while they're quickly trying to set up these lights. He's just standing there.
He's just standing there, menacingly!
And it's just, it's so painfully boring.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's actually the one time in the movie that Gyra just kind of like loses some of his menace. Like, he's just not doing anything, and the military is just getting ready. And it's weird. It's weird. I think boring kind of. If you asked me to describe this movie in one word, that would be it. Boring, dull. It crawls.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll give you the setup is annoying, like it takes way too long, but I do not find the actual Mazer attack annoying or slow or whatnot.
I don't either. It gets to the point where I'm just like ready to stop paying attention by the time that part rolls around.
That's fair.
Well, and it's kind of a shame because like we've said, the effects are so rad, and like it's all done at like, I think it's like nighttime, right? Isn't it like dusk something?
Yeah, like right about to be nighttime,
which is cool. Like, I'm a sucker for like all those old Showa like tanks and jeeps that like the headlights on them in the night scenes. Like, it's something about it that's just really comforting. But no, it definitely goes on. It actually to a point where when they had started, I like looked down and checked my phone or something. And I looked back up and I was like, did the movie skip or something? Because it felt like it was the same exact scene I had just watched like 2 minutes ago. But, you know, again, like I said, it is worth noting that this is the first appearance of the Maser Tank, which would become, like, you know, a huge part of the, like Brendan was saying, like it becomes a huge part of this franchise and this genre in general. So like it is important. But yeah, like most everything in the movie, it's just kind of like, bleh.
I just want to say I find the ending tragic. It doesn't really prevent how much of a slog the movie is, but it really does end on a kind of nice, bitter note.
When the movie ended, I had this feeling of, man, that was pointless. Like, I feel like, again, if they had given that whole plot more time, then yeah, the ending I would have probably hit me pretty hard. But they introduced Sanda just too late and don't do enough with it.
I'm in agreement there. It's a tragic ending, but it doesn't really have the impact it feels like it should have. But my God, is it beautiful. That eruption, even on the classic media DVD, which has one of the worst officially released transfers I think I've ever seen. I felt like I was watching it in 240p on YouTube. It's gorgeous. I love the look of that sequence. And the music is beautiful, too. I noticed a lot of the music in this movie is, and I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I know a lot of the music in this movie is reused in other ones, but I don't think I've ever heard that bit anywhere else before. And it's really gorgeous.
I wonder if anyone has actually seen like a good version of this, because if that's the version that's been officially released in the States, I don't know what the Criterion one like looks like or sounds like, but the classic media one is like, I have DVD rips of VHS bootlegs, like movies that have never been officially released except for VHS that look better than this one does. It is astounding.
I should have confirmed this, but I do believe that there is an HD version available. As a matter of fact, I think HBO Max has it. Maybe Brendan can confirm, but that's what I read in a couple of reviews. But it's only the dub, or one of the dubs. I think probably the international dub.
Yeah, I only got the international dub. I know because I've watched the original and I didn't get the most annoying of Tamlin's ad-libs.
I feel like I'm missing something big about Sanda and Gyra, but I honestly for life of me can't figure out what that would be.
There's not a whole lot there. I feel like everything else that we could talk about is projection. Like, I feel like you have to literally work internally to, like, make this movie, like, weighty.
Well, and I mean, it's hard because there's a lot of things that are great, but it's also, like, I feel like just some overarching comments have kind of covered it. But, like when they're trying to pull up the, I think they're fishing, and, like, Gyra appears out in the distance, and he, like, comes up and, like, all the nets get dragged out and everything. And like, Nakajima's brilliant. Like, he is wonderful in this. And I know that he's said that this was his favorite role because he got to emote more and he got to show his eyes and it allowed him to kind of convey more emotion. And I think that really comes across. I mean, you can tell a distinct difference between Gyra and Sanda, which sounds like, you know, obviously, but I mean, if you watch like maybe some of the Heisei Godzillas, there's nothing super incredible or distinct about maybe Godzilla and Space Godzilla. Like, there's differences, but they're more subtle compared to, you know, Gyra, which is he's very animated, he's very vicious, he's very fast, and Sanda's much more reserved and kind of just his way outside of protecting humans. There's something very defensive about him and his body language. Yeah, I mean, there's really not much more. I don't really have anything else to say except for, like, musing about just how rad Nakajima is.
So let's move on to the score for this film, which was composed by Akira Ifukube. Like I said earlier, I watched the US dub of this, which replaces a lot of Ifukube's score with certain other Ifukube tracks, as well as just, like, stuff from other movies, but the main theme is there. Which I feel like is good, but I feel like doesn't totally fit the tone of the movie. Like, most of it does until those blaring trumpets hit And then it just sounds kind of like, I hate to use this word in a negative way, but it just kind of feels a little like cheesy, you know? Like it feels like a little too campy for like what this movie is like going for.
I really like this movie's score. I think maybe I agree a little bit that high-pitched trumpet is sometimes timed a little weird, but I think that like stuff like I think it's Gyra's theme. It's this really, really uneasy sounding brass. It almost has like a seasick quality to it. I think it's wonderful. I think it is perfect for Gyra. And then there's moments like the ending I touched on earlier where you have that beautiful, like, trumpet. I believe it's trumpet. I think it's a solo during the eruption. And it's this really, like, wailing, mournful trumpet, and it's gorgeous. Stuff like that, I think in a lot of places, I think that the score is, like, next to Gyra himself, is probably the strongest part of this movie. There's also a theme in here that gets reused. Maybe it gets reused in other movies, but it most notably to me, it gets reused in Terror of Mechagodzilla. It's a slower, softer theme, and I think it's really beautiful, too.
I really do love those beautiful, softer themes that we get throughout the movie, like Elfie was saying. And I do really love the Mazer March. That's a classic song to me. But this never stood out with me, this, the other Ifukube scores. Especially this watch, because, like, again, I don't know what transfer they're using, but the HBO Max version was, like, literally hurting my ears at some points. The audio was so screechy. But I don't have anything else to say. I think the score is neat.
Yeah, I really don't have much to say about the score, honestly. The two things that are notable to me are Gyra's theme, which I know Elfie had mentioned, that to me almost sounds a little like what would later become Batra's theme, where it's sort of just like this menacing, brassy kind of little like drawn out segments. And then the military march theme. Whether it's new in this or it's been used other times, it's a familiar theme and I like it and it fits. Other than that, I really don't have much to say about it.
Just on the military march thing, I unfortunately didn't get to experience whatever military march you were mentioning because in the dub I watched, it was replaced by, I don't know what movie it's from, but something from another movie. And every time the military was on screen, no matter what they were doing, they were playing this track that like looped over and over and over again, like just some kind of like, supposed to be some kind of rousing score. It just was driving me insane. It was so loud in the mix. It was like so ear piercing. And it was just the same thing over and over again. And I just wanted to like rip my ears off and just throw the TV off the balcony. Oh my God. It drove me insane. And that is my only other thought on score. Oh, except that at one point in this dub, they started playing the Godzilla theme while Gyra was on screen. So that was stupid. So yeah, those are my thoughts on score.
Nick, I hate to say it, but we are forgetting a certain piece of music we should probably be bringing up.
Oh no, you're right. Oh,
Brendan.
Damn it, Brendan.
I'm sorry, but we have to bring up.
Talk about the damn song.
Yeah, I was going to say, no one said it yet. And I'm just, I almost made a joke earlier. I was going to introduce myself with a fucking, I hope the words don't get stuck in my throat joke.
Thank you, Brendan. Very cool.
Yeah.
The words get stuck in my throat. The words get stuck in my throat.
So she's singing the song. It's not a good song. I mean, like, look, okay. I don't think it's the song itself that's bad. Like, I think the instrumentals are pretty cool, but her voice, it is so grating. It feels like my ears are bleeding. It's terrible. It's just like, and I'm sorry, I don't want to fucking rip on anyone, but man, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. But it's funny though. Gyra is like about to eat her and then he decides not to. I don't remember why. And then he drops her and she like lands face first. And I'm like, damn, that's like intense.
And she doesn't move at all. Like they never show someone checking on her. She just gotten brutally murdered.
That sequence is just, it is so bad. The song is so grating, but I think the worst thing is just how long it goes. I didn't time it, but it feels like it goes on forever. And you're just, you know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen before it happens. And you're just like waiting and waiting and waiting, like, please, Gyra, please stop this.
The only real thing I have to say about this that no one else has said, because, like, I agree, it's awful. Everything about it's awful. I actually almost skipped it on this watch. But it's pretty cool, actually, maybe, like, 6 months ago or something, my son was watching Scooby-Doo Mysteries Incorporated, and they actually have a cover of that in the show, and I was like, I know that. I thought that was pretty rad.
I do really love that how it's used in Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, but it's not, it just grinds the whole movie to a dead halt. Like nothing else, just hear the song number. Okay, now back to the kaiju. It's not good. It's really not good.
I don't have any stray thoughts. I don't know about you guys.
In the graphic novel Kaiju Max, about a kaiju prison, one of the recurring characters is Green Humongo, an aspiring rapper.
Good.
At one point, he puts on a Hamilton-style production retelling the story of Gojira. It's a very good comic. I recommend it.
I don't have a lot to say. I just kind of wanted to read off some of my stray notes as my stray thoughts. Not all of them, just a few. Like, Russ Tamblyn, LOL. Russ Tamblyn, LOL. Thank you, Gyra, which I'm pretty sure was when he stops the words get stuck in my throat sequence. I was very grateful.
Yeah, I have that same exact note. A real hero moment.
Santa has cake. I am so bored. Oh no, not more tanks. And volcano pretty.
I think I know the answer to this question, but who's your MVP of this movie, guys? 3, 2, 1, Haru Nakajima.
Yeah.
Russ Tamblyn. No.
Get out.
Thank you for joining us for Elfie's first and last.
Yeah. No, it's Nakajima. Like, he carries the movie. It's him and it's Isabel.
It is. It straight up is. There's no question.
He carries the movie. I considered the Santa actor and Kumi Mizuno, but it's gotta be Nakajima.
I mean, I will give a shout out to Sekita as Santa. I mean, I think they play off each other relatively well. But yeah, I mean, Nakajima just absolutely nails it. The body language is perfect. The emoting is super good. He's like fucking crazy, man. Like that fight is so brutal. Like there's so much like hair pulling and choking and it's so frantic.
Yeah.
It's just he totally kills it. Before we move into our final thoughts, let's hear from Evan, who couldn't make it today.
Hey everybody, Evan here. I was not able to join for this episode as much as I would have liked to talk about War of the Gargantuas, especially because this time through I had a much better time with it than I usually do. So I'm sorry that I couldn't come along to express my enjoyment, but I did want to pop in just long enough to talk about one of my favorite enduring elements of the movie. And this is an enduring movie. This is a movie that has had a big impact. You know, it's a favorite of Guillermo del Toro's. It's a favorite of Tim Burton's. Brad Pitt has cited this as the movie that first made him want to be an actor. But I want to talk about another very, very influential and pop culturally significant aspect of the movie. If you watch the Japanese version of this movie, you will notice that the fifth billed actor is Kip Hamilton. In the U.S. version, Miss Hamilton is elevated to second billing above Kumi Mizuno and Kenji Sahara, second only to Russ Tamblyn, who is, of course, third billed in the Japanese version. But that's not really a relevant tangent. Miss Hamilton, like Russ Tamblyn, was brought to the table by American co-producer Henry Saperstein, and she is the woman who performs the song The Words Get Stuck in My Throat. I'm sure you all remember it. If not, I'm sure that Nick has edited in a snippet of it to remind you.
And the words get stuck in my throat. The words get stuck in my throat.
So it's a catchy song. It is. It's, you know, it's not perfectly performed by any means. There are some sour notes in there, and the band actually messes up the intro a little bit. But it's a cool, catchy number, and it has lived on. A lot of viewers, well, let's just go with younger than myself, may very well remember that the song was featured in two episodes of Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated. It showed up in episode 109, Battle of the Humongonauts, which obviously owes more than just that song to War of the Gargantuas. And then it popped up again in episode 218, Dance of the Undead. But oh, that is not my favorite cover of Words Get Stuck in My Throat. Not by any means. No. For I, friends, am a Devo fan. And our beloved Spud Boys, the De-Evolution band, did the Words Get Stuck in My Throat as a pretty frequent closer for their live performances in the late 70s. I should say that they did a what has been called a deconstructed version of the song as a frequent closer in the late 70s. They've issued the song twice on official releases, a live version on the Rarities collection Recombo DNA, and a studio version on the also Rarities collection Pioneers Who Got Scalped. Now, neither of those is currently in print, but these days, you know, with your YouTubes and whatnot, it's pretty easy to track down both, as well as some other live recordings of Devo doing Words Get Stuck in My Throat. Mark Mothersbaugh would sing the song in character as Boogie Boy, who is his falsetto voice, baby-masked, post-apocalyptic mutant persona. And it's not to everyone's tastes, but if you like your music a little deconstructed, it's a wonderful, wonderful version of the song. I adore it. I'm so, so glad that it exists and that these two things that I love came together in this really cool way. It is by far my favorite example, at the very least, of American artists covering a kaiju song. Also, there's a story about Russ Tamblyn meeting Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, and Mothersbaugh telling him, you know, you're in my favorite movie. Tamblyn assumed that he was referring to West Side Story, but of course, no, not our devolved boys. Not that Devo haven't also shown an interest in West Side Story. The also out-of-print live Devo album, Now It Can Be Told, Devo at the Palace, does, after all, feature as its encore a medley called Somewhere with Devo that incorporates the song Somewhere from West Side Story, but oh look, that's another irrelevant tangent. My MVP for this movie is Haruo Nakajima, who of course plays Gaira. I think it's one of the best performances in the genre. I think what I respond to in particular is the fact that while Gaira is the villain and is sort of painted in the movie as the evil Gargantua, for the most part, I don't feel like he's being portrayed as malicious so much as he's being portrayed like a hungry, confused animal. And particularly, I love Nakajima's body language once Sanda has turned on him and he's in a more defensive mode. The stuff that he does with his shoulders and his arms really sells the idea for me that this is an animal that, you know, feels threatened and sort of betrayed. And where Sanda is, you know, coming at him and shaking his head no, that defensive response that Nakajima gives is... I actually feel some sympathy. I feel bad for Gaira because he doesn't understand. He's just an injured animal with no socialization that's trying to eat.
Thanks for sending in your thoughts, Evan. It's been weird recording an episode about a Showa-era Toho kaiju film without you being here, so it was really nice to hear from you. Yeah, so I think we covered War of the Gargantuas as good as we can, so let's move on to our final thoughts.
It's a cool movie. It's got some really cool monster stuff. It's got some really amazing effects. It's got a couple good songs. I mean, ultimately, I don't know if it's worthy of its reputation in terms of, like, everyone would have you think that this is, like, the hidden gem of Toho's monster movies. But it's cool. I mean, if you're a fan of the genre, obviously you're going to want to check it out. But I would temper expectations. I think it's fun. I think it's cool. But I also think it's kind of drawn out and a little dull. But it does make up for that with the effects and Gaira himself as a character and as a kaiju. So worth a watch, but definitely not the best thing Toho has done.
It's a movie with good scenes and good potential, but it never comes together in a way that works. Definitely not one I'd recommend. Though I will admit, it did have its influences there, here and there.
It's hard for me to talk about this movie without also referring to its reputation within the fan base. It's really talked up, and I don't see it. I think that it's a movie that had good intention and really good ideas behind it. But for whatever reason, I don't think any of it comes together. I think that there are good individual pieces, but I find it really, it's almost spectacularly dull. It is a movie that, for me, it's something I would put on if I needed help falling asleep. And it's a shame because I really love a lot of the ideas. I think that there's a lot of potential, especially with that relationship between Sanda and Gaira. I think that concept of finding someone like you and then being utterly disappointed by who they truly are and wanting so badly to, like, to change that and having to come to terms with who they are, that is extremely compelling in the abstract. And I really wish that more had been done with that.
I feel like I've said it a million times already, but I just find it uninteresting and unengaging until, like, the last third or so of the movie. I don't know. I just feel like it could have been a lot better. That's really it. Before we go, as always, we've got listener feedback to read out. Two of which come from none other than Ethan Storang. The first one, about episode 49, which was one of our Godzilla the Series episodes, reads, "Excellent episode of G-Force, everyone. It's truly a testament to what an entertaining show you all put out that, even during coverage of episodes like Freeze and Bug Out, I find myself listening with rapt attention. Not to mention getting a great deal more enjoyment out of the coverage than the source material. While I did enjoy elements of Bird of Paradise, I love Quetzalcoatl's design and enjoyed the central conflict, I ultimately found this episode a bit boring. I could not, for the life of me, stop zeroing in on all the Velociraptor sound cues this episode stole from Jurassic Park for the mini cues. I also found it fascinating that the way this episode parsed dinosaurs and birds being evolutionary neighbors was in having scaled feathers. I'm flabbergasted that your Zone Fighter episode on Balgaris is one of the least listened to episodes, considering it covers a run of some of my favorite episodes of Zone Fighter and has some supremely entertaining commentary to boot. I suppose an episode of G-Force has to be the least heard, but if I had to wager a guess as to which, I'm not sure that episode would crack my top 10 list of suspects. Deadlock was an absolutely wonderful episode. I loved the plot, I loved the villain, and I loved the Manta-esque Mosasaur? That can't be right. Nope, it says right here that they insist this giant danger noodle is, in fact, a Mosasaur. Paleontological data aside, this episode was a standout for me, and would be my standout of this run were it not for the next episode. Competition was incredible. A name-drop reference to Akira Ifukube, a Mechanicong in all but name, an homage to Mr. Rogers, a giant demon serpent threatening Japan, and a Godzilla Mechanicong team-up? You'd be hard-pressed to cram more incredible elements into a single episode. Your discussion of Godzilla's sparing use and lack of development throughout the series kind of brings up an issue I have with the show as a whole. Regarding Godzilla movies in general, I'll often say that, while monster fights are fine and dandy, and creature designs are a great thing to nail, movies will usually live and die by the affinity I have for the characters, the level of engagement I have in their storyline, and the ways in which that story informs what happens with Godzilla and vice versa. In the animated series, I've realized that, while Nigel is a precious gift, Mendel Craven is a great character, and Monique frequently gives me reasons to keep appreciating her presence on the team, the human element of the show, and their accompanying storylines, motivations, and overall lack of development just don't hold a lot of interest for me. This is thanks in large part to really lackluster writing for them, inconsistent motivations across episodes, and a general aforementioned lack of development across the team. It's really led to my enthusiasm for the show flagging as it's gone on. Ultimately, it's a show about Godzilla, and not only would that lead me to finishing my watch through even without G-Force reviewing it, that alone will lead me to watching it again someday. On the other hand, this lack of effective utilization of its human characters and regular development of unique and engaging storylines for them to get caught up in will likely lead to the series' relegation to the bottom of the Godzilla heap in my heart. And nothing good ever lies at the bottom of a heart heap. Can't wait for G-Force's next episode. Feels like it's been a long time since I've heard G-Force coverage of a Gamera film, and I agree that those episodes tend to be among the podcast's best. So long, G-Force. I've been Ethan, and who can forget that time in 2010 that he thought he was related to Wes Craven and tried his hand at creating a reboot of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. Truly terrifying in all the wrong ways. This next bit of feedback from Ethan is about our 50th episode, which was about Gamera vs. Giron. Happy 50 episodes, G-Force. I think it's a testament to how entertaining and insightful you all are that you've managed to make those 50 episodes seem like far fewer. I can't believe G-Force has come this far. Here's to another 50 and beyond. My thoughts on this one are relatively sparse, thanks to your commitment to covering every aspect of Gamera vs. Giron. There's not a lot I can say that you haven't already said much more expertly. I don't think it will come as a surprise for me to say that I love this movie. It's such a quirky, fun, and lighthearted movie, undercut with moments of extreme brutality. For example, brain consumption, the stark ideology and execution of Terran philosophy, and the gleeful mutilation of space gauss that almost serve to make one empathize even more with the world and the viewpoint of the children protagonists over the world adults have made. I always feel that Akio's speech about not pining for other worlds beyond Earth, imploring us to enjoy and improve our own, serves as somewhat of an entreaty to viewers both young and old not to abandon the innocent, naive, and kind-hearted world that children inhabit in pursuit of the world of adulthood. It's entirely possible I'm reading too much into his speech, but I've always felt it worked well on both fronts. I absolutely agree with the take that Akio's father died in a traffic accident. It's such an oddly specific pull that I always felt there had to be a bit of an explanation for it. And my mind long ago made the link between his absent father and his vision for a better world. Having said that, I also like the real-world connection with latchkey kids in Japan, mostly because I think it's extremely fascinating how kaiju films from this era, All Monsters Attack / Godzilla's Revenge being the most prominent example, dealt with the phenomenon. It's interesting to me how these films served to both bring a broader awareness to the world in which these children were growing up, as well as forge a connection with the younger viewing audience through the use of children protagonists with relatable experiences. In lieu of being able to name Kano Mora or Miyuki Akiyama as MVPs, I'm going to go ahead and name the unknown actor who played Giron. I think they absolutely nailed the expression of Giron's personality through the physicality of their performance, and find it sad that they remain such an unsung hero in the annals of kaiju suit acting. This has been Ethan, and it was a sad day for the Terran Empire when they screwed around once again with kitchen implements and ended up with Togekiidon, a fearsome four-legged knife sharpener kaiju who, when paired with Giron, rendered the pair unstoppable. Fortunately, he's been much less of a threat now that Gamera has put an end to Giron's reign of terror. This last bit of feedback comes from Kyoe Toshi on Twitter, also about our 50th episode. This was in response to Andrew's comment about the trajectory of the missile that killed Flobella. Kyoe says, "Hi guys, just a note on the trajectory of the missile in Gamera vs. Giron that kills Flobella. If you watch the scene closely, Giron is being targeted by the missile, but it hits his blade head-on and is bisected and veers to either side. The new trajectory of one half kills Flobella, and the other half gets caught by Gamera, who tosses it back at Giron, embedding it in its shuriken launchers and kablam! That's why the flight looks so wonky. The bisection scene goes by in a split second and almost everyone misses it. Just another reason to love the film, not to mention how Giron gets blown into two parts, wholly inconsistent with the epicenter of the explosion. Thank you, Kyoe. Like I said to you on Twitter, I would say that that makes more sense, but it honestly doesn't. But that's okay, because that's a huge part of why Showa Gamera films are so much fun to watch and are so delightful. And also thank you to Ethan Storang, once again, for always sending in your wonderful feedback. Your kind words are so encouraging, and they help us to keep going. So if you want to send us feedback like Ethan and Kyoe did, you can hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at GForce Kaiju Pod, Facebook if you type into the search bar GForce a Kaiju Podcast, or you can just go to facebook.com/GForceKaijuPod, and you can email us at GForceKaijuPod@gmail.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We would greatly appreciate it, and we will read your review on the show. Those reviews help us reach a wider audience, so if you want to help us out, that would be greatly appreciated. And you can also rate us on Spotify if you'd like. Thank you so much for listening, and join us in 2 weeks whenever we cover the next 5 episodes of Godzilla the series. So to close us out, we will each be going around and saying which artists we think should have been performing in Kip Hamilton's place and got attacked by Gaira afterwards. So I've been Nick, and I really think that we should have seen Imagine Dragons perform and get attacked by Gaira.
This has been Parker, and I, you know, honestly, if I had to pick, I think I'd have to pick Imagine Dragons. Like, I could just imagine them up there singing Thunder, and Gaira shows up all pissed off. Like, I don't know, that sounds great to me.
Wow, that's a good one, Parker. I've been Brendan, and I would do Imagine Dragons. You know, I could just see them, like, going like, I'm radioactive, I'm radioactive, and then just like, ah! You know, it just feels right, you know?
This has been Elfie, and I guess I would have to say Imagine Dragons. I just think it'd be funny, because they fucking suck shit. Oh my god, Shasta, no. Not now.
Shasta cameos!
Oh, shit.
That completely slipped my mind. Holy shit.
Okay, fix your camera so we can see her.
Wipe all the pixels off.
Yeah, I just was gonna say that I don't even remember now. Is my background like totally black?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fuck yeah.
I knew it. I knew you were gonna say
Goth Force. Goth Force.
Go Marl.
Tell her I love her.
Just a cameo. Woo!
Yeah,
baby! That's what I'm waiting for! Woo!
Can you imagine we had an episode? Imagine we had an episode with Shasta and, like, Ruby.
Oh my god.
Dude, I miss the Ruby cameos so much.
Same. Me too.
Iconic.
Although Jack purring that one time was, like, the greatest thing. Elfie just scared the shit out of me. Oh my god. You, like, went over and, like, turned on your light, but I thought you, like, went into through the door, and then I just see you run towards the fucking camera. I'm like, what the fuck is that?
You looked like some, like,
oh my god,
ghostly woman.
You looked like Mama. And, like, Mama runs at the camera, and, like, all of a sudden you see this, like, thing, like, towards the camera, like, what the fuck?
I actually totally forgot that I have notes. One of which is Santa has cake.
I'm pretty sure he was eating people, Elfie, not cake.
No, Santa didn't eat anybody.
Oh, shit, you said Santa. You meant...
No, I mean Santa has a fat ass.
I know what it means. I was making a joke, damn it. I don't know what you just said.
I have no idea what you just said either, but you killed Brendan.
I heard something about... a fish.
Brendan, are you okay?
I'm actually choking on food because from that, holy shit.
Like, he's kind of cool. You know what?
Parker, wait, I accidentally muted you. Sorry.
Well, listen, if you want to stifle the truth, you want to cut off the truth, I'll tell you about the truth, okay?
Okay. Shasta.